boys and girls, thank you for tuning in to Truth to You. That's truth number two, letteru.org. And it is time for Treasures from the Tanakh with Ira Michelson. G'day, my friend.
Hey, Jono, how you doing? How is it over there in the Miami Beach of Australia?
In the Florida of Australia. You know what? It's been kind of cloudy over the last 3 days. What's that about? You know, the motto of Queensland, I don't know if they still use this, but they used to use this in their tourism ads. Beautiful one day, perfect the next.
Well, you know what? We've been having terrible weather in Florida.
So I hear. Last I heard, there was some sort of cyclone approaching. Is that true? Hurricane?
Yeah, I think there's a tropical storm coming. But you know, I'm usually locked up in this little room, so I don't hear much about it. You know, I don't even. You know, sometimes Lori calls me and she goes, "So what's the weather like there?" I say, "I don't know."
You're not the outdoors type.
Well, I mean, I am, but I mean, I do so much with the radio and doing this show and others.
True.
And trying to keep up on the social media and all the Facebook pages, and Torah threads. And
yes.
So, you know, generally I get out to walk the dog outside, and if it's raining, it's raining, and if it's not, it's not.
So, and that's the weather update.
You know, and if I take him out, it may not be 2 or 3 hours before I take him again. So,
you know, it's really,
you know,
funny.
If I went out, you call me in the middle. I'm like, well, I haven't been out in an hour or two, so I don't know what the weather is.
It's funny you should say walking the dog. We awoke to a knock on the door because we're at my father-in-law's place, and we're looking after it while he's traveling around in his motorhome. He's gone, you know, into the outback of Australia, the other side of Australia. I don't even know where he is. He's out there somewhere. And we had a knock on the door this morning from the neighbor returning the dog. The dog here is a little Jack Russell. Actually, he's kind of a big Jack Russell. And he's a good-natured dog. But apparently last night he got bored and he dug underneath the fence and thought he'd go and visit the neighbor's house. So
now, is that your dog or his dog?
No, it's his dog. It's his dog.
Oh.
Oh, dear me. But, you know, fun and games. And it's still nice up here. You know, it's still kind of warm. And, you know, I may get to the beach tomorrow if it finds up a little bit. But I'm having fun while I'm up here in the Florida of Australia, Bribey Island, Queensland. Mm-hmm. So, listen, you also mentioned Torah threads. Now, I just went to your website and, boy, it looks good.
Thanks. You know, it's exciting.
Yeah, good. No, let me encourage the listeners to go there. If you haven't been there already, it's a great website. Boy, it looks good. And it's really convicted me. Because TorahThreads.com, check it out. It's very neat. It's just clean. It's a beautiful website. I love the way it looks, and it's easy to navigate around. And as I say, it's convicted me. I you know, listeners, be warned. Over the next few weeks, we will be continuing to renovate the Truth to You website in a major way. And because Ira's not allowed to have a better looking website than me, so I have to do something about that.
But we do have the link under Learning and Faith. If you go to the website under Treasures for the Tanakh, and you have the entire archive of the teaching on Job up until, you know, this one,
that's
from Job chapter 1 to Job chapter 30. If people
that's
that
true.
Are listening haven't heard, you know, all of our teachings on that, what we've done,
mm-hmm.
you and I.
Mm-hmm. So you should be able to find them on Truth to You, but you won't, and there will be delays. But in the meantime, if you get stuck, certainly go. You'll find it all on TorahThreads.com, TorahThreads.com. You'll find all of those Treasures from the Tanakh episodes, plus more, everything else that Ira does and other people as well. It's all there. So let me encourage you to go. Also to Torah Threads on Facebook, the Facebook page, and Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page. You'll find those there. But today, my friend, we are in Job chapter 31.
Yeah, we're almost done. We're almost done with Job.
No, we are, because it's in chapter 32 and onward. It's a new era in the book. It certainly is, and so there is a conclusion of sorts here. And well, I'll tell you what, I'm just going to start. This is verse 1. It says,
So wait, before you do that, okay. I want to give some upfront material here.
Go on.
Just to get us started, to show the contrast between where we ended last time in Job chapter 29. And so what ends up happening is, of course, we've been talking about that these are, you know, meshalim, that it's a mashal, you know, these poetic kind of proverbial things that have been going on, and this is the final part of the second one. Mm. And what we see is that Job goes through a list of all his moral qualities, and in some ways it resembles what we read in chapter 29. It resembles it, but actually, if we look really carefully, we'll see a difference. Now, if you read verses 12 through 17 of 29, it says, "Because I delivered the poor that cried, the fatherless also that had none to help him, The blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I clothed myself with righteousness, and it clothed itself with me. My judgment was as a robe and a diadem. I was eyes to the blind, and feet was I to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and the cause of him that I knew not I searched out, and I broke the jaws of the unjust and plucked the prey out of his teeth. And so in that section, we read about his position of influence in the community. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of Job 29, if we remember that. And it would seem that he did these things for the good of the people. Now, I've made this argument before, and you know I like to give the different perspectives. So I'm kind of going in a similar direction as to what Job's attitude was. Mm-hmm. So like I said, I've made the argument in the past that perhaps we're looking at the difference between one who has a sense of duty and one who has a true love for God. In other words, when we look at some of the things he says, is he saying that because he loves God, or is he saying it because he had a sense of duty or obligation because of the position he has? Mm-hmm. And so in developing the picture a little bit further, I want to illustrate some things from some of the rabbinic texts. Which kind of speaks to this. Mm-hmm. And the first one is in the Talmud, in the first tractate in Berachot 17a. This is what it says. It says, when Rav Yochanan completed the book of Job, he said this, a man's end is to die, and an animal's end is for slaughter, and all are poised for death. Fortunate is the one who grew in the Torah, and whose toil is in the Torah, and who gives pleasure to his creator. Mm. And so the reason why I read that is because based on that, it is possible to think that Rav Yochanan might have been contemplating the same thing that I'm saying, that he was contemplating the attitude of Job, because the last thing is about, you know, this is fortunate is the one who gives pleasure to his creator. Mm-hmm. And he says this after reading this. And then we can contrast the attitude of Job with that of another person who was named Nachum Ish Gamzu, who was actually a teacher of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva was one of the sages in Judaism. And his name is described in the Talmud as having grown from his tendency to reject or to react to misfortune with unyielding optimism. In each case, they said, uttering a phrase that became famously attached to him. And that's how he got his name, Nachum Ish Gamzu, because he would say, Gamzu Litova, meaning this too is for the best. And the two words Gamzu, meaning this too, were combined into the single word nickname Gamzu with Ish Gamzu, then meaning it basically meant the Gamzu man, or the this too man, is what this guy ended up being named. Mm. Because there's a story about him that in later years, his feet and his hands became paralyzed, and he was afflicted with other bodily ailments. And it was said that he bore the troubles patiently. And not only did he bear them patiently, that he even rejoiced over them. And there's a story that says that some of his pupils questioned him as to why, since he was a perfectly just man, he had to endure so many ills. Mm-hmm. And he declared that he had brought them on himself, because once when he was on the way to his father-in-law's and was carrying many things to eat and drink, he met a poor man who asked him for food. And the story goes that as he was about to open the bundle, the man died before his eyes. And in deepest grief and reproaching himself with having perhaps caused by his own delay the man's death, he cursed himself and wished himself all the troubles to which his pupils referred. And then there's other various stories that are told of miracles that happened to him as well. Mm. And so I tell that story only because to kind of contrast it and say, so the question is, did Job, in spite of being called righteous, do what he did out of a sense of duty or out of love? Because somebody can be righteous. I mean, somebody can do the instructions of God, but what is the motivation behind it? Is the motivation behind it a sense of duty and obligation, or is the motivation out of love? And Job tells us about his obligations and how they were faithfully discharged, never slipping into the forbidden. And his kind of argument is, what more can be asked of me? Mm-hmm. Whereas Nachum, that we're talking about, however, he was so permeated with a burning love, always seeing himself as falling short and thinking that there was always more that he could have done. Mm. And so I just wanted to start with that to kind of contrast that, yes, Job could be called an Ish Tam, a righteous man or a blameless man as it relates to keeping God's instructions, but we always have to check the motivation. And we have to check our own motivation too. Are we keeping Torah? Are we doing those things that we're called to do as obligations to God? Or are we doing them out of a permeated burning love that's in us.
That is a fascinating concept to something to contemplate. Surely, I'd love to turn that over to the listeners and open that to the comments section. Does it make a difference in the end if you are obedient to the Torah and you are faithful to God's instruction? Does it make a difference what your motivation is? That's an interesting question. I mean, we could talk about that for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we could. And the point that I would make is that I see a difference in it. I mean, I don't know that it affects anything in the long term, although it could have short term effects. It certainly doesn't affect our long term ability to enter into the Olam Haba, the world to come. But certainly, if we're only doing things out of obligation, do we go over and above the obligation and have a motivation out of love to do things over and above?
Okay.
That would be and it's an area that I fail in myself, which is why this really has been so profound for me in these last couple of chapters.
Yeah, I have to
really caused me to ask myself that question. What's my motivation?
Yeah, and particularly this chapter, I found particularly convicting in some areas. But I would love to hear from the listeners on that. And please, listeners, if you do have an opinion, give a couple of examples from the Tanakh, if you can. If you can find a couple of examples of your position, love to hear from you. So it begins this way, chapter 31, verse 1. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? What is he saying?
Well, it's interesting because the first two words in the Hebrew are brit karati. And karati, we always see that as from karet, which means to cut off. So he's actually saying, I made a covenant of cutting off my eyes. And what then should I direct my attention to the young maiden? So he's, this is a very powerful concept, especially in light of the last few Torah portions that we've studied, if people are following the Torah portions. And the reason why I say that is because, and for instance, since last week's Torah portion, we had the sin of the spies who caused Israel to remain in the wilderness for 40 years. And it's said because of their eyes. And at the end of the portion, we then see the commandment for the wearing of tzitzit. And what does it say in verse 39 of Numbers chapter 15? It says, and it will be to you fringes to look at them and remember all the mitzvot of God to observe them, and you do not taruru, okay? It's the same word used for the spies, that you don't spy out after your heart and after your eyes, which you are harlots after, or which you lust after. And so in essence, the concept of the tzitzit was almost a rectification for the sin of the eyes.
Sure.
Of always constantly looking at things the wrong way.
Yep.
The other interesting thing for me is that, so what he's basically saying is that he's basically now speaking about his moral values. Like in the last, chapter 30, 29 and 30, we saw all these moral obligations, how he took care of the poor and he did all these things. Now he's basically telling us how pure he is, that I wouldn't even look at a nice looking chick, that I made a covenant with my eyes to not even look at the virgin, the young woman who's not married and lust after.
Now, hang on. You just said a couple of definitions there. Which is it? What word are we looking at when we say a young woman?
Well, we're not saying young woman. It's actually the last word. So the whole verse says, Brit karati le'enai uma et bonen al betula.
Betula.
Okay. Betula.
Okay. Let's just hop on this for a second, because you said a young woman, a virgin, but which is it? Because we also have in the famous verse of Isaiah chapter 7:14 uses the word, at least in the Christian translation, uses the word virgin. Is this the same word or is this a different word? If it's different, how did the definitions differ?
Well, it's totally a different word. So bitula is always going to be related to the virgin. Okay. So when we're seeing here, we know that this is a girl without any sexual experience with men. Okay. In the Hebrew, bitula is a virgin.
Okay.
You can translate it young maiden, but from a Hebrew perspective, in the Hebrew language, this is talking about a girl who has not been with a man. This is talking about a virgin.
Okay.
Okay. But when we look at, you know, that famous verse that you're talking about in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, that's usually translated as the virgin shall be with child or some sort of, is that how it reads?
In the New King James it says, I will give you a sign, behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son,
right,
and his name will be Emmanuel. So it says, what do we have for virgin there? What is the word?
So the word in 7:14, hu lachem ot hine ha'alma.
Alma.
Okay, alma. So alma, when we look at alma, it actually has, it's not always like we see betula, where betula is always going to be a virgin. Okay, alma can be translated young woman, and in many cases is young woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some argument back and forth, and it has to be according to the context as to whether or not this is somebody who is a virgin, because in some context, it's speaking about a girl who is marriageable. Okay,
so this is now
a girl who's able to be married.
This is interesting,
but it doesn't have the same exact. Like, in other words, if you look at the most respected lexicons, like, for instance, if you look at Halot, which is the Hebrew Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament, which is one of the most respected lexicons out there, which is, by the way, a Christian lexicon, the first thing you see when you look up Betulah is virgin,
mm-hmm,
okay? Period, virgin. You know, if I look up, if I look up Alma in Halot, what it's going to say is things like, you know, a marriageable girl.
That's exactly,
a girl who's able to be married.
That's exactly what I've got. That's exactly what I've got in the study notes of my New King James Bible. So that's really interesting. So what you're saying is Betula is specifically a virgin. Alma is someone, and I'm reading from the study notes in my New King James on this particular verse, Isaiah 7:14 says, the Hebrew word rendered virgin means a young woman of marriageable age. That's what they said. Well, then why are they using the word virgin?
Well, because the argument that they would make is that, well, in order for her to be marriageable, she would have had to be a virgin.
Can it not also apply to a young woman who is married, Alma?
Yeah, it's possible. It's very possible that it's a young woman who's married. The point that we would make is if the author wanted us to know for absolute certainty that it was talking about a virgin, the word in Isaiah 7:14 would have been Betula and not Alma.
Betula. Okay, and that's what we. That's
the point.
There it
that's
is.
That's the point that always gets missed in this argument that goes back and forth. And again, when I bring these things out, I'm not bringing this out to tell anybody what they should believe or what they shouldn't believe. But what I'm saying is that if you're gonna be like us, if you're going to be people like us that are going to study the Tanakh and say, I want to know what the context is, I want to know what the language and the context of the scripture is, then it's silly to take verses and spiritualize them or hyper-spiritualize them to support a particular theology.
Amen.
And so quite frankly, again, if the author, if Isaiah wanted to impart the fact that this person was a virgin, he would have said Betula. He wouldn't have said Alma, because Alma leaves it open to the potential that it's not a virgin.
Amen.
But in Betula, there's no question.
And this is the word that's used in 31 verse 1. It goes on to say, for what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? And now he goes on to talk about his steps, right? He goes on to talk about his conduct.
So in these first four verses, we read about what he has avoided. And then here, and moving ahead, we hear of what the punishment or curse might be if he actually did these things. I call it the if section.
It's the ifs. I was just about to say, this is the if section.
Yeah, it's the if section.
And it's followed by, he's got, if I've done this, if I've done that, if I haven't done this and I haven't done that, well, then may such and such happen to me. And he pronounces a curse upon himself. And it's very interesting, Ira, how the extent that he has to go to convince his listeners that something horrible might happen to him if he's lying, because he really has to go to some extremes because he's in such a terrible state. He has to go far and beyond that. Right. So the if section begins in verse 5, if I have walked with falsehood or if my foot has hastened to deceit, Let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity. Let me be weighed on honest scales. What's being implied there, do you think?
That he's been weighed on dishonest scales?
No, but how? Weighed with what? Weighed how?
What do you mean?
Well, see, it takes me back to Ezekiel chapter 18.
Okay.
And it talks about, the verse is 25, I think it is. Yet you say... The way, and this is Yehovah speaking through Ezekiel to the to Israel in general. You say, the way of Yehovah is not fair. Hear now, O house of Israel, is it not my ways which is fair and your ways which are not fair? When a righteous man turns away from his righteousness and commits iniquity, he dies in it. It is because of the iniquity which he has done that he dies. And again, when the wicked man turns away from the wickedness which he committed and does what is lawful and right, he preserves himself alive because he considers and turns away from all the transgression which he committed, he shall surely live. He shall not die. Yet the house of Israel says the ways of Yehovah is not fair. Now, O house of Israel, is it not my ways which are fair and your ways which are not fair? Now, my understanding is the word for fair is probably better rendered as weighed. Is it the same word?
Yeah, it actually is.
It's the same word.
So the word there is yitachen, okay? And it's the root of it is to weigh or to regulate. So, it's definitely talking about, but that's why I said what he's basically saying. This is why I question his attitude here. And that's why I've questioned his attitude in several of the chapters, because he's basically saying the same thing that they were saying in Ezekiel 18. He's saying, let me be weighed with honest scales that God may know my integrity. Well, what are you saying, Job? You're being weighed with dishonest scales? And if you're being weighed with dishonest scales, whose scales are they?
And indeed, is he being weighed at all? Is he suggesting that his good outweighs his bad and therefore he is being treated unjustly? Is that what he's suggesting?
Well, I absolutely think he's doing that. But, you know, what I think he could be alluding to is more of the friends, you know, what they've been saying, because he's basically saying that if I was weighed with honest scales, then God would know my integrity.
Okay.
So I don't know that he could necessarily, you know, so I don't know. I just don't. I think that we have to give him the benefit of the doubt here.
Because
I still think his attitude is wrong, but I think we have to give him the benefit of the doubt of who he thinks is weighing him with unjust scales.
Because after this, what Ezekiel delivers in chapter 18, and he says, yet you say, being Israel, the way of Yehovah is not weighed. In other words, this doesn't seem fair that you don't seem to be weighing our good against our bad. What you're saying is, you know, a man can be wicked all his life and yet turn at the end and do what is right and just, and you will declare him faithful and he will live. They struggle with that. But here it's interesting, and here's something for the listeners to consider, and I'm going to have to think about it a little bit longer as well. But Job is saying, let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity. So it's interesting,
right?
And it may serve towards the alternative view that you're offering,
right? And we have to remember the context of Ezekiel 18 as well, which is that, you know, they originally came and they were saying that you're punishing us for the sins of our fathers,
And that the sons can. It says that the soul whose sins shall die, the son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son, which is echoing Deuteronomy 24:16. I love Ezekiel 18. If you haven't studied it, dear listeners, you need to do so.
Yeah, how could you not love Ezekiel 18? Because basically what God says when everything is said and done, do I delight in the death of either the righteous or the wicked? He doesn't delight in death. He says, do I delight in the death of the wicked? No, repent and live.
Therefore I will judge you, O house of Israel, everyone according to his ways, says Adonai Yehovah. Repent and turn from all your transgressions, so that iniquity will not be your ruin. Cast away from you all the transgression which you have committed, and get yourselves a new heart and a new spirit. For why should you die, O house of Israel? For I have no pleasure in the death of the one who dies, says Adonai Yehovah. Therefore turn and live.
Awesome.
Always can't miss an opportunity to read.
Love that. I love Ezekiel
chapter 18. It goes on to say in verse 7, if my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow another and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. And just in verse 7, where it says, or my heart walked after my eyes, there it is echoing what was said in the first verse. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, again echoing the first verse, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow down over her. Does that mean what I think it does?
Wow. Well, there's two possible interpretations there. You know, of course, some people like to give the lighter interpretation, but it actually can mean just what it says, what it sounds like.
Okay.
You know, which is kind of interesting language and a poetic language of, you know, the Bible.
Mm.
But basically what he's saying is that this verse 10 would be punishment for the above verse that we see in verse 9. You know, if my heart had been enticed upon a woman and I have lain in ambush at my neighbor's house. While someone can be viewed as impeccable in their public behavior and beyond approach, Job is arguing that even his heart is pure here.
Now, this is an interesting thing, Ira, because...
But there's also the other interpretation that does not have a sexual connotation, which is that it would mean that she would be forced to, into menial kind of labor.
Mm.
You know,
she would be beneath. She would be beneath others.
Yeah, she would be beneath. Yeah, she wouldn't have the position that she had as his wife.
Now I'm going to go for the former for what he says in verse 11. He really emphasizes.
Yeah, absolutely.
He says that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be.
And you know what that word wickedness is?
What's
there?
That?
Fornication.
Ah, well, there you go. Okay, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So some translate it differently. It's the word zima, kihu zima, viyu avon plilim, aflilim, I'm sorry. For that is wickedness, but it could mean fornication. It is judged iniquity.
Okay.
So some relate that zima is related to planning. Like, in other words, the fact that this is premeditated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Job is claiming that this would never be part of his character.
That's right. And that lends to the emphasis that he puts on cutting off the eyes, and obviously not cutting out his eyes, but obviously closing his eyes or turning his eyes from lusting after another woman and so that his heart may follow his eyes and actually do something in regards to his lust.
Right.
It all is somewhat related there. And it goes on to say, for that would be a fire that consumes to destruction and would root out all my increase if I have despised, here's some more ifs, if I've despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up, when he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he, now this is interesting, I've got a question about verse 15, did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not one fashion us in the womb? Now, I checked this in a couple of translations. In the New King James, interestingly, it capitalizes one. I know there's no capitals in Hebrew, but it's interesting that they saw fit to capitalize one. I went to my new JPS. It also capitalizes one, and it seems to be echad is used here, and I'm interested if you agree, is it used as a description of God?
Well... It could, in a way, and the reason for that is when we look at, there are two different words that are used here for womb,
mm-hmm.
Okay, in the verse. We have, in reading the verse in the Hebrew, it says, halo babeten, okay? Mm-hmm. Halo babeten, oseni ashu vayichunenu berachem. Echad, okay.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at that, the first word for womb that is read is this word vabeten, which can mean in the belly, okay? And it also has this idea of womb. But the second time we see it is that word barechem, okay? And then we see echad. Now, why could it potentially be related to God? Because rechem is the same root for the word compassion,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And the reason why rechem is that is because we see that the greatest love that there is, and often you see in Hebrew the word rachamim, and you always see rachamim related to God. In most of the liturgy, in the Jewish liturgy, all through the morning blessings, there's always this idea of rachamim, mm-hmm. rachem, this idea of the compassion of God. And it's related to the womb because there's no greater love, there's no greater compassion than a mother has for the child in the womb. Mm. And this is, so when it talks about rechem, it absolutely could have that idea. And certainly that one at Echad is absolutely speaking about God. And did not one, you know, Echad, you know, God, establish us in the womb, establish us in compassion.
Amen.
You could even say. So it's really... The other thing that's being said here is that he's trying to present himself as one that, although he had position, which is funny because when we read in 29, he tells about all the things that he did and the obligations and how great he was. But basically here he's trying to say that one station in life doesn't play into this. And you could make the argument that we're all descendants of Adam and Chava and all equal in God's eyes.
True. And that's another interesting thing, and we will get to that, but he does make a reference to Adam. We'll get this shortly. But it goes in 16 and says, "If I have kept the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten the morsel of my by myself, so that the fatherless could not eat of it, but from my youth I reared him as a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow." I've got in italics. Verse 18 is a little bit, what do you do with that?
Yeah, it's just one of those verses that's one of those head scratchers. You know, because basically he's talking about that, you know, he was a father to the fatherless, you know, father to the orphan, and from my mother's womb I have led her. So the only thing that we can do is make the argument, like you said, that he's talking about the widow.
Yeah. So I've got it in brackets here, as if he's interjected and affirmed that, you know, but this is what I've done. That kind of makes sense to me. And verse 19, "If I've seen anyone perish or lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me." Now I do have an asterisk there next to heart, and it says,
because it's actually loins,
literally loins. "If his loins have not blessed me," what is it conveying there?
Well, it's conveying the fact that, you know, that the person's loins would bless him because they were not left out in the cold without something to keep them warm.
"And if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless when I saw I had help in the gates, then let my arm..." Now, here it is. This is how far he had to go, Ira. "Then let my arm fall from my shoulder, let my arm be torn from the socket."
Yeah, so basically when we look at 21 and 22 together, you know, when he says, "because I saw my help in the gate," you know, remember, we're talking about this guy who was, you know, a very high position, would have been considered an elder, and where did the elders hang out? The elders hung out in the gates, the gates in the city. So he's basically saying that knowing that I was so well respected in the gates where the elders sat, if I raised, you know, my hand to an orphan, the courts would have exonerated me. You know, they would have vied to me rather than the orphan that said I raised my hand to him. But he's saying, if that's the case, let my shoulder fall from the shoulder blade and my arm be broken from the bone. He's basically saying that the hand that he lifted should be broken, that at the forearm broken from the elbow, and the shoulder should fall from the from the shoulder blade. And this is what we call in Judaism, there's a term we call midah keneged midah, which is measure for measure. In other words, if I raise my hand, I'll lose the use of that arm, which is midah keneged midah.
So again, I mean, it's pretty extreme. And he's saying, if I haven't done this, may this be done to me. He's pronouncing a curse upon himself. And he has to go to such extremes because he's in such a bad way. It's not as if he can say, Ira, let me be diseased, or let my skin turn black and fall from me, or let my bones burn with fever, or whatever it is. He has to go as far as to say, may my arm fall from my shoulder, may it be ripped from the socket. Severe stuff. "For destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence, I cannot endure. If I have made gold my hope, or said to find gold, you are my confidence. If I have rejoiced because my wealth was great, and because my hand had gained much, if I had observed the sun when it shines," and literally it says the lights, but goes on to say, "or the moon moving in brightness, so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand." Now, it says this also would be iniquity deserving of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. Now, that's kind of the sun and the moon, so that my heart had been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand, verse 27. What do you make of that?
Well, I just want to go back a little bit and cover a couple of things really quick. So in verse, just really quickly, before we get there, in verse 24, There's two different words for gold there. There's actually gold, and then there's fine gold, which is the gold from Ophir that we read about sometimes. And that's the gold, you know, that's fine gold that even Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, received that shipment of gold and precious stones and sandalwood and silver and ivory and all kinds of animals, you know, every couple of years that we read about in the Tanakh. And it actually talks about this. There was actually a piece of pottery that was found at, in what's now modern-day Tel Aviv that was dated to the 8th century BCE. And it bears a Paleo-Hebrew script, the text of which says gold of Ophir for Bet Horon. So it kind of confirms the idea that there was, you know, that actually was a place, and they actually did bring gold from Ophir, that it was this fine gold. But when we read in 26, to answer your question, if I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon on its, it actually says on its precious walk.
Oh, really?
Or on its course. Yeah. Yeah. In the Hebrew, you know, v'yareach yakar holech, and holech is to walk. Okay. So it's on this idea of this upright or precious walk, talking about the course of the moon. Mm. So what this really is referring to is idolatry. That basically what he's saying is, and my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand, that not only was my heart far away from idolatry, but my mouth as well. That I never looked up and in my heart thought to look at the sun or the moon as something to be worshipped, and not even with my mouth.
So it was never, my heart was never secretly enticed to worship the sun and the moon, and my mouth has kissed my hand. Is that a gesture of worship?
It's actually more of the idea of putting his hand over his mouth.
Okay.
You know, like clapping his hand over his mouth.
Okay.
You know, like see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Interesting. And it goes on to say, if I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted myself up when evil found him, and again, I've got brackets, it says, indeed, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul, end of brackets. If the man of my tent, the men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his meat? Again, I've got in brackets, but no sojourner had to lodge in the street, for I have opened my doors to the travelers, end of brackets. So he's saying if, and every now and then he's saying, but I, you know, of course I never did that.
Right. So, you know, he remember we said these are the ifs.
Mm.
You know, he's basically saying that, you know, with that person that he, you know, the person that, you know, he wouldn't wish evil upon, or, you know, even with his mouth to cause an oath, you know, on his life. Mm. He's basically saying, I could have easily brought more trouble on this person.
Mm.
You know, he could have, you know, in his position, he could have called in a debt, or causing him to swear a false oath in his calamity. If the guy was in dire straits, yeah. You know, make an oath. And he's saying, oh, but, you know, but I've never done that.
Mm.
And as you said in verse 32, you know, this idea of, you know, the idea of being satisfied with the meat, the stranger did not lodge outside my doors. I opened to the path or to the roadside.
Yes.
So
that people didn't have to lodge in the streets. They could come and eat and be accommodated. He was accommodating. He was hospitable.
Less or, you know, except the times that he gave his sheepskins so that they wouldn't be cold outside.
True.
And their loins blessed.
He's looking after them. But here,
yeah, he's looking after.
Here in 33, this is interesting because it makes a reference back to the creation story. It makes a reference back to Bereshit. If I have covered my transgression as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom,
Adam, like Adam or like man. So yeah, it definitely can be seen as a reference to that.
And
we certainly knew that he hid his iniquity.
Yeah.
You know, God called out to him and, where are you, Adam?
Yeah. And he said, I'm hiding.
And
by the way, it was the woman's fault. And it's interesting. It's worth noting too that if you sit down with a cross reference copy of the Tanakh, a Bible cross references, there is a lot of Torah in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to note and go through those. 34. Because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families, so that I kept silence and did not go out of the door. Oh, that I had one to hear me! Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. What's going on there?
Yeah, so, you know, so we're getting back into this idea of the legal language. And we saw it before. I kind of skipped over it. But, you know, when he talks about his, you know, manservant, maidservant, mm-hmm. you know, it actually talks about him hearing their case. Mm-hmm. And it was actually in legal terms. So we see some of the legalese, you know, the legal language embedded all throughout, you know, the chapters. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, when he's talking about this idea of, you know, of not going outside, you know, trembling at the multitude and being dismayed by the contempt of families and, you know, was silent and did not go outside the doorway. You know, he's basically saying that unlike the person that, you know, that tries to conceal, you know, the sin in their bosom, he's saying, I never tried to conceal anything that would cause me, that might come to light, you know,
so,
to the multitude.
So he's saying if only there was a written record of my conduct, is that what he's saying?
Right.
That's what he's saying.
Well, he's basically saying, who will set to me to hear? Basically, who's going to give me a hearing? Mm-hmm. Okay. Remember, he's been dying to have somebody, you know, be his, you know, defense attorney, so to speak. Mm. And behold, here is my mark, my signature. In other words, he's saying, I've been marked by everybody else as this unrighteous guy. I'm telling you that everything that I just read is my mark. That's my signature. I should be marked with that.
Fair enough.
You know, Ishtam, the righteous guy.
Yep.
Answer me. And he actually says, Almighty, answer me. Oh, that I had the document which a man of strife has written. So it's this idea of this another legal term related to an indictment that would be written by someone who had a dispute with you.
Right.
So it's in other words, he's saying, here's my mark. I'm the righteous guy. Show me the document. Show me the evidence. He's almost like, I mean, he doesn't know what's going on in heavenly court. But basically what he's saying is a man of strife has written. So basically he's saying, you know, show me the document that Hasatan, that the adversary has written against me. You know?
Surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. Yeah. I would declare to him the number of my steps like a prince. I would approach him.
Right. So he's looking for the one who would write his brief and take his side in this legal battle, like I said. Mm-hmm. And he claims that he's so righteous that it'd be inscribed on him like a seal or a mark. Mm. And this is his signature. Actually, I think we have a reference in Job chapter 14.
Verse 16?
Yeah.
For now you number my steps, but do not watch over my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you cover my iniquity.
Right. So he's kind of making a distinction between what he said before. It's kind of a different thing. You see the same idea of the seal or the mark being spoken of, and the idea of the covering of iniquity, and yet he's coming out with a different kind of, you know, argument here at the end of this one. So I just wanted to show the contrast between those two, that he's used similar language before.
Now, yeah, he has. I want you to remind me of something. I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head, but these last three verses, a few more ifs. If my land cries out against me and its furrows weep together, if I have eaten its fruit without money or caused its owners to lose their lives, and here it is, then, and he pronounces another curse on himself, then let thistles grow instead of wheat, and weeds instead of barley. Now, have we, and then it concludes with, the words of Job are ended. Do we, going back, what Yehovah allowed Hasatan to touch, was his fields among that list?
Well, you know, we certainly would have to believe that because, look, I mean, he lost everything. He lost his family. These would have been, you know, his children that would have worked the fields, you know, as well, his workers and everything else. You know, if he's, you know, we've made this argument that, you know, the way he looked, you know, it's very possible that he was in the heap, you know, in the, you know, in an area similar to Gehinnom, you know, where the fires were burning and where the lepers would have hung out. And, you know, he certainly wouldn't have been overseeing the work of his fields, and you know.
So I'm back in chapter one, and it says that the Sabaeans raided the workers of the field, and they killed the servants. Right. And then it goes on, and it says that fire fell from heaven and burned the sheep and the servants, those who were tending the sheep. It goes on to say the Chaldeans formed three bands and raided the camels and took them away.
Right.
Speaking, and then it goes on that the great wind that struck the sons and the daughters and they died. There's nothing specific that I recall in regards to his fields. Yes, they must be neglected now, but it seems like. Then there must be something about his. I mean, if his fields have gone to ruin in the last few months,
right? Well, I'm saying there was nobody to take care of them. That's the whole point. I mean, he certainly couldn't hire new people and certainly didn't have anybody to oversee.
But now he's saying, if what I'm saying is if I'm lying to you, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley.
Right. So that the, these last three verses, kind of change, from the tone of the ifs and ifs and ifs and ifs, and it kind of ends the mashal. Basically, it's more of poetic language. I mean, he already knows what's happened, and I don't know that he's necessarily speaking, specifically about the plantings of his own fields, because when we look at 39, if by strength I have eaten the fruits without money or made its master despair, instead of wheat, let thorns go out, and instead of barley, foul weeds. Mm. And then the words of Job are complete. Mm. So for me, it's more of poetic language here.
Sure.
I'm kind of sad and happy at the same time. I'm sad that we're not going to hear Job, go from, being humble one minute and having an attitude with God the next. Mm. It's been fun these first 30 chapters, 31 chapters. Mm. But, it says the words of Job are complete. And so in a sense, even though he's had nobody to bring his brief or to stand, he's basically been his own defense attorney. Mm. And, we have a saying, I don't know if you know it in Australia, but, in the States we have a, we have the old saying that, a man who defends himself has a fool for a client.
Right.
So, but we have him basically resting his case, and this is all we hear from Job now. Yeah. And we see some brief interactions when God comes on the scene later in the book, but not any kind of, soliloquies and, meshalim like we've heard.
Of course, he had no alternative. He had no option. He had to do it this way, of course. But the whole dynamic of the book changes. We've only got, 41 chapters, I think, in the book of Job. 42, sorry, my mistake. 42. Mm-hmm. We're now up to 32. And so this is the last quarter, I suppose we could say. And the whole dynamic changes with the introduction of Elihu. We're going to get to that next week and see what he has to say. But
he's going to... What we're going to see from Elihu is that, we see this young stranger that comes on, and he seems at least to provide an answer that eluded, the senior friends mm-hmm. of Job. And just as quickly as he appears from nowhere, he quickly fades into the background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we have God appearing and having his say.
Amen. That'll have some clarity there, no doubt. Ira Michelson,
yeah, definitely.
My friend, thank you so much for coming back on to Truth to You. Treasures from the Tanakh, dear listeners, and TorahThreads.com. TorahThreads.com, a website so much better than mine at the moment. I'll have to see what I can do about that. In the meantime, dear listeners, next week, chapter 32, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.